Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jaleel, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday the 25th of August, these are our main stories. The head of Spain's Football Federation insists he won't resign over his controversial kiss at the Women's World Cup final. The Kremlin denies having anything to do with the presumed death of the Wagner mercenary chief.
Of course, there's lots of speculation about this plane crash and the tragic death of the passengers, including Yevgeny Prigozhin. In the West, this speculation comes from a certain angle. It's all a complete lie.
Donald Trump becomes the first US president to have his mugshot taken in his latest criminal case. Also in this podcast, how Taylor Swift's international tour could have a huge economic impact on the cities she visits. It was supposed to be a contrite resignation for sexist behaviour that shocked a nation and the world. Instead, at an emergency meeting on Friday, Luis Rubiales, the head of the Spanish Football Federation, abruptly announced he would not go.
No voy a dimitir. No voy a dimitir. No voy a dimitir.
The audience, mostly made up of men, applauded him. Mr. Rubiales has come under growing pressure to quit since forcibly kissing one of Spain's players after they won the final of the Women's World Cup. It had been expected he would announce his resignation at this meeting, but instead he's vowed to fight on, accusing what he calls false feminists of trying to kill him. He did apologise for grabbing his crotch while sitting next to the Spanish Queen and her teenage daughter, but described the controversial kiss as consensual. Semra Hunter, a football journalist in Barcelona who was watching the meeting online, gave me her reaction to Mr. Rubiales' refusal to go.
I would say on the one hand, I was completely gobsmacked. On the other hand, I was not surprised at all. The reason I say that I was gobsmacked is that because after FIFA came out yesterday and said that they were opening disciplinary proceedings against him, it was very widely thought that he was going to stand down at that point, because up until FIFA came out, he had no intention of resigning. And so if you know the character and the person that is Luis Rubiales, it doesn't actually come as a surprise that he has, in fact, decided to double down, stay in the position and make some pretty horrendous comments to the assembly today, only for the people in the audience to actually applaud him in response. So now you can only imagine that it's just caused a huge firestorm here in Spain of people now pleading to the government, trying to go through that avenue in order to push him out.
And just talk us through what happened, because he was making some quite incredible statements. And as you say, he was applauded for them.
He made comments in no particular order, basically blaming false feminism and saying that it was a scourge of society and that it was a character assassination, a societal assassination, that everybody was coming after him. And he was thanking everybody who stood by him, who convinced him to actually fight this, and he's going to fight it until the very end. He actually doubled down as well on the kiss itself. He called it a peck rather than a kiss. He said it was mutual. He said it was consensual, and he kissed Jenny as if he would kiss one of his own daughters. So he feels as though he's clearly done nothing wrong. He says that everyone has been after him for the last 5 years, and quite frankly, with good reason. If you look up all of the history of scandals that are associated with him, then it really is no surprise that there have been a slew of official complaints have gone after him, allegations that have to do with criminal activity, with misogyny and sexism. So it's really quite astonishing that he has decided to come out and basically fight this until the very bitter end, and essentially he will probably fall on his sword here. But it really is quite shameful that there are people in such a position of power who think this way, who behave this way, and it just shows that it's going to be very difficult to fight against unless now people in the government will make the right call here and do something about it and get him out of the position that he holds.
Because there's a lot at stake here. It's not just the way female players are treated in Spain, but Spain is also bidding to host the World Cup in 2030.
Absolutely. And that was one of the main reasons why people thought he ultimately was going to step down, because there was so much political pressure for him to basically put an end to this whole thing. Because Spain does want to host the Men's World Cup in 2030, along with Portugal and Morocco. So that's why, at least the media are saying that for the longest time, he actually has been protected, because the government didn't want to make a big fuss about all of the other scandals that he is associated with, because it is a stain on the country. It makes the country look bad, and it severely damages the candidacy that they put forward in order to host it. There's also some very, very serious allegations of Luis Rubiales recording for years now private conversations of high-ranking officials within the government, and basically using that as leverage in order to keep him in the position, which is why the media are saying he's been protected. As I say, there have been formal complaints that have been put forward now to the courts as of today, and it does seem as though there is going to be some kind of prosecution or proceedings that are going to be carried forth along with, in parallel, FIFA, to ultimately see what is going to be the outcome of all of this.
Football journalist Semra Hunter. From the moment reports emerged the plane carrying the Wagner mercenary chief, Yevgeny Prigozhin, had crashed in Russia, frenzied speculation erupted that President Putin had ordered a hit on the man who staged a short-lived mutiny 2 months ago. Now the Kremlin has issued a denial. Asked by the BBC to comment on these reports, the spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, called such speculation a lie.
Of course, there's lots of speculation about this plane crash and the tragic death of the passengers, including Yevgeny Prigozhin. In the West, this speculation comes from a certain angle. It's all a complete lie. When we talk about this issue, we should be guided only by the facts. We don't have many facts at the moment. The facts need to be clarified during the official investigation, which is being carried out now.
The Kremlin spokesman also said it was impossible to tell whether President Putin would attend Yevgeny Prigozhin's funeral, since he has, quote, a very packed schedule. Mr. Putin waited a day before offering his condolences to those who died on board the plane. Our reporter in Moscow, Will Vernon, questioned Mr. Peskov.
I've just got off the phone. There was a Kremlin conference call today. This is a conference call with journalists, Russian journalists and foreign journalists based in Moscow. It happens most days here in Moscow. It hasn't happened for about a week. So it was the first one today since that plane crash near Moscow that reportedly killed Yevgeny Prigozhin. And I asked the Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, what was his reaction to all these accusations, mostly from Western officials, that it was the Kremlin that was behind the plane crash that reportedly killed Yevgeny Prigozhin. This is what he told me. He said it was a complete lie. And he said that, you know, when we talk about this issue, we should be guided only by facts. We don't have many facts at the moment. The facts need to be clarified during the official investigation, which is being carried out now. So in some ways, echoing some of those comments that President Putin made on Russian television last night, he also urged people to await the results of the official investigation. He also, as you remember, expressed condolences to the families of those killed in the plane crash and also paid tribute to Yevgeny Prigozhin, but stopped short of unequivocally confirming that the Wagner boss was killed in that plane crash. So, you know, Kremlin spokesman today echoing President Putin, but also going further when asked by the BBC specifically about those accusations that it was the Kremlin that was behind that, and a very firm denial from the Kremlin spokesman there.
Well, Will, you know, I think it's fair to say that some people consider Russia's relationship with facts to be quite an interesting one.
Yeah, that's right. I'm sure this will convince almost nobody, if we're talking about those people, of course, that suspect it was the Kremlin. Because if you watch Russian television, obviously there is no mention whatsoever of the possibility that possibly Russian authorities, Russian security services were behind this. On Russian television, the message very much is that, well, it's pretty factual, actually. There was a plane crash. Officials are looking into it. And that's about as far as it goes. But, you know, you're right. The Kremlin doesn't have a great track record on this. Whenever they are accused of almost anything, be it doping, state doping of athletes, be it poisoning opponents abroad, poisoning the opposition leader Alexei Navalny, the list goes on, committing war crimes in Ukraine. Of course, the Kremlin tactic, the classic answer to all that is always deny, 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 deny. And that's exactly what they've done today.
Will Vernon in Moscow. As we reported on Thursday, Japan has begun releasing treated radioactive water from the wrecked Fukushima nuclear plant into the Pacific Ocean, a move that has caused much controversy in the region. Now the plant's operator says samples of seawater taken from around the facility are safe. China imposed a ban on all seafood from Japan following the water release. A spokesman for China's foreign ministry, Wang Wanbin, said Japan is spreading the risk of nuclear pollution to other countries, labelling it extremely selfish.
The Japanese side must change its course so that the water of Fukushima will not be the shame of Japan. Another point is that in response to the selfish and wrong move of the Japanese side, China and other countries have the right and responsibility to take legitimate, legal and reasonable measures to ensure a sound marine environment and the health and well-being of people.
But the operator of the plant disputes that. More from our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow.
The operator of the nuclear power plant, TEPCO, has had quite a simple message, really. It says that the first tests of seawater carried out after the release of water began showed that the contamination was in acceptable levels and was essentially safe. Now, this is the operator of the plant giving a news conference. Also, you have at least two government departments in Japan which will be testing water, and release of those tests will come over the next couple of days as a fisheries ministry and the environment ministry. Also, the International Atomic Energy Agency is on site and it's testing water as well. It tested water before it was released in the sea. It's going to be continuing doing that. So you've got a whole raft of agencies and organizations testing this treated water, essentially to try and convince people in Japan and Japan's neighbors that this water is safe and it's not going to contaminate fish to be used as seafood from around the plant.
And they'll have a lot of convincing to do.
They do have some convincing to do, but a lot of the anger, it's got to be said, is quite political. As I mentioned there, the International Atomic Energy Agency has been involved in this process and it's given approval to the release of water. And the release of this water, it's got a certain amount of radioactivity still in it, but acceptable levels, is an accepted practice at nuclear power stations across the world. So Japan isn't really doing anything that other countries aren't already doing, including, in fact, China, the biggest opponent. So there's a lot of politics involved in this. So regardless of what the science is going to say, I think you're going to see countries like China still making political capital out of the release of water. So it's going to be really difficult to convince them if it's politics and not science which is driving your opposition. It's going to be very difficult for Japan to get China to change its mind.
Michael Bristow. The cost of living crisis has become so acute in Brazil's biggest city, Sao Paulo, that it's estimated as many as 50,000 people there are sleeping rough. In a country known for its inequality and expensive housing, even the slums or favelas are becoming unaffordable. The city is having to think of new ways of trying to get families off the streets, as our South America correspondent Katie Watson reports.
This is Paraisópolis, Paradise City in English. The music belies the truth in this colourful neighbourhood. For residents here, life is hardly idyllic. Paraisópolis is São Paulo's biggest favela, and the difference between the haves and the have-nots couldn't be clearer here, with expensive apartments towering over this chaotic but lively community of badly built houses and unpaved roads. Eliarni Carmo da Silva shows me around the tiny room that she and her husband Adriano share. It's in a little alleyway off the main road, on the ground floor, with at least two stories of informally built flats above her. They pay $73 a month for a space that fits a double bed, a cooker and a fridge, but little more. I can see mould growing on the wall too, but they can't even afford this modest space. Eliane shows us the school uniform of her six-year-old granddaughter who comes to stay here. Eneli has a heart condition, and the little they earn goes on medicine to keep her alive. While their landlord's understanding, it's getting harder, despite being given food and aid from local charities. But for some families in other parts of Sao Paulo, life is even harder.
We're in the centre of the city next to an elevated highway known as the Minhocão, which is really famous here in Sao Paulo. And underneath there are dozens and dozens of tents, many of them with blankets that have been given to them by the city council to protect them from the cold temperatures that we're experiencing here.
As the number of tents multiply, the city council's struggling to fix the crisis. In the north of the city, a makeshift village has been created. There are 20 or so boxes that look a bit like shipping containers, and they're positioned to form a little square. In one corner is a playground, families milling around. The aim is to house 4,000 people in villages like this one by the end of the year. Carlos Becerra Jr. is the social welfare secretary at Sao Paulo City Hall, which is in charge of the project.
It's a way of looking after people based on the well-known international concept of housing first, offering housing as the first step in helping to get them back on their feet.
Daniela Martins shows me around her micro house, as they're known, 18 square meters with a simple kitchen and bathroom inside. There's a double bed that she shares with her husband, Rafael, and their four-year-old daughter, Sofia, and a cot for three-month-old baby, Henri. The pandemic hit them hard. Neither Danny or Rafael have jobs, and they lived in a shelter for 8 months before this opportunity came up. At least for Rafael and Danny, it's a start.
This is a place where we are trying to get back to living in society, to be a human being, you know. We just want a normal life. So many employers think that people who live in a shelter are bad people.
For good and bad, the hope is that staying off the streets at least gives these families a fighting chance of a better future.
That report by Katie Watson. Still to come in this podcast, new research finds that gut problems may be an early sign of Parkinson's disease.
What they want to do is figure out if the brain and the gut are intimately linked. Would there be a way not just of flagging the problems early?
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. For most people, the moment of having a mugshot taken is one of deep shame, a permanent reminder of a criminal arrest. But not for Donald Trump. As you might expect, he's doubled down, actively promoting the mugshot with his first tweet, or should I say X, in over 2 years. And the official Trump website is currently selling T-shirts, bumper stickers and, suitably enough, mugs emblazoned with the photo, captioned, "Never Surrender." That bravado is certainly winning support and money from his Republican base. But the charges he faces in Georgia are serious ones, centred around an alleged conspiracy to undermine the election result there. He's the first former or serving US president ever to be indicted. This was his fourth arrest in 5 months in a criminal case. On his way back from the jailhouse in Georgia, Donald Trump spoke to the media gathered outside his private plane.
When you have that great freedom to challenge, you have to be able to, otherwise you're going to have very dishonest elections. What has taken place here is a travesty of justice. We did nothing wrong. I did nothing wrong. And everybody knows it. I've never had such support. And that goes with the other ones, too. What they're doing is election interference. They're trying to interfere with an election. There's never been anything like it in our country before. This is their way of campaigning. And this is one instance, but you have three other instances. It's election interference. So I want to thank you for being here. We did nothing wrong at all. And we have every right, every single right, to challenge an election that we think is dishonest, that we think it's very dishonest.
Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, told us about this latest chapter in the Trump saga.
This is undoubtedly a dramatic moment. This may be the fourth set of criminal charges that Donald Trump is facing, but it's the first time a photograph's been taken as he's been processed. And it instantly went around the world as an iconic image, which can mean what you want it to in many ways. He's staring belligerently into the camera, and you can read into that what you like. He clearly thinks it looks defiant and strong, and he's been posting it with slogans like "Never Surrender" under it, as he maintains that he has committed no crime and done nothing wrong. He called into a right-wing television station, Newsmax, when he was on his way back to New Jersey from Atlanta, and described the experience he had when he turned up at the jail, which is a notoriously violent prison. He talked about what it was like to be processed through this notoriously violent prison, and also said before today he hadn't known what a mugshot was.
I came in, I was treated very nicely, but it is what it is. I took a mugshot, which I never heard the words mugshot. That wasn't, didn't teach me that at the Wharton School of Finance.
Donald Trump has been wearing all of the indictments against him as a badge of honour and using them to bolster his presidential campaign. He will do the same with his image. It will be adopted as a campaign symbol or emblem. And it will further his case that he is being victimised, that he is the victim of a witch hunt by Joe Biden, who is scared of Donald Trump running against him in the presidential election. This is a story he's been telling his supporters with great success. And it has allowed him, up until this point, to basically defy political gravity, with his poll ratings increasing the more crimes he's charged with. And the same is likely to happen with this image. I mean, you know, mugshots have sunk careers in the past, long before any verdict was delivered in a court case. This, Donald Trump clearly thinks, is going to help his campaign, and that's why he's sharing it so widely, using it to raise campaign finance, and it will become emblematic of what he sees as his fight against the establishment. And that is one that is very successfully binding his base to him and reaching out into other parts of the Republican Party. Because remember, at the moment, as he's chasing the Republican Party's nomination to be their presidential candidate, he's not appealing to the wider electorate. He needs to speak to diehard Republican voters who will turn out in the primary elections and, he hopes, make him the party's official candidate.
Sarah Smith. Well, Brian Lanza is a Republican strategist who used to be Donald Trump's communications director. My colleague, Martha Carney, asked for his reaction to the dramatic moment when the president's mugshot was made public.
My friends were telling me, and you know, it sort of feels like the movie Batman, and they put the bat signal out, and they've activated the Trump army here in the United States. It's pretty crazy right now. He's back on Twitter. He's probably back on Twitter to raise a lot of money, because that's where a lot of his supporters are, and Twitter's a very effective fundraising vehicle. And the mugshot was probably going to be a $20 million mugshot for the campaign.
$20 million in terms of fundraising?
Correct.
And it will become famous. It's already famous.
I mean, it's already iconic. You know, it's one of the most, you know, I mean, we have a lot of iconic photos here in the United States, Iwo Jima, 9/11. But I guess it's up there in historical moments in the U.S. It is. I guess it is now. Yeah, it's crazy.
But I suppose those are moments, Iwo Jima, great moments of heroism from the Second World War, 9/11, the tragedy, but also the heroism of the first responders. Are you really putting it in the same category as that?
Well, you're asking me, you know, is it a photo that's going to sort of be viewed and remembered 20 years from now, similar to those images of Iwo Jima and similar to those images of, you know, of 9/11? Absolutely, the photo is going to be viewed in that context. You know, I'm not equating it with the emotional or the physical or the mental stuff with what took place at those particular moments. But if you're talking about the image itself, it's going to be one in the history books, you know, for the rest of American history, and certainly embedded in the minds of the American psyche for the next 50 to 75 years.
How do you think Donald Trump himself is really responding to all of this? Because if we think back to the very beginning of these legal actions, and that does seem like a long time ago, he was very concerned about having to do things like the perp walk, as it's called.
Yeah, listen, I think there's been an evolution. I think, you know, if you look at the first indictment, there are still questions as to how the general public was going to respond to that. And he gained 10 points. You know, and so, you know, the second indictment, he gained another 5 points. The third indictment, he gained another 10 points. I mean, he's gone up 25 points since his first indictment. So I think from, you know, that point, you know, as him looking at the political structure and the political challenges ahead of him, you know, this has now become a plus. You know, like these indictment days have become the new rallies. I think on a personal level, you know, he's probably, you know, he's human just like everybody else. You know, I don't know if he's scared, but he certainly knows the challenge ahead of him. You know, he's been attacked since he jumped into politics since 2015. I mean, this is 7 years of just constant attacks, constant investigations, constant impeachments, Mueller, Russia. I mean, so for him, you know, it's not like it's a shock to his system that somebody's, you know, attacking him.
And he's doubled down on his approach in terms of attacking the legal system as political. In an interview that he's just been given to Newsmax, he's again attacked the district attorney in Georgia.
And it's working. I mean, you already see the polling data here in the United States that there's prosecutorial fatigue.
Donald Trump's former communications director, Brian Lanza. Now, have you ever had a gut instinct or butterflies in your stomach? Well, these are just two signs of how closely our brains and our guts are linked. New research published by the British Society of Gastroenterology suggests that gut problems may be an early warning sign of Parkinson's disease. Our health editor, Michelle Roberts, told us more about the study.
The researchers looked at around 24,000 people with Parkinson's, and they compared them with some other people who had different brain conditions as well as healthy brains. They wanted to see if there were any symptoms beforehand that might help to predict the onset of Parkinson's. So specifically, they were looking for problems with the gut. And they found that when they looked back at the medical records of these people in the US, they found that those who went on to get Parkinson's, some of them did have some early gut problems. And also when they flipped it the other way, they looked whether people with gut problems had a higher chance of developing Parkinson's. And the answer was yes for that too. That doesn't mean that everybody who has a gut problem will go on to get Parkinson's, but there does appear to be this link that they're interested to explore more.
That is interesting. So what kind of gut problems, and can they explain this link?
So Parkinson's obviously is a problem with the brain, and it's a neurological thing. Now, the gut problems that they were looking at also seem to be nerve related. So it's things like constipation, difficulty swallowing, and irritable bowel. So things about how the bowel's moving, which is quite interesting. What they want to do is figure out if the brain and the gut are intimately linked, would there be a way not just of flagging the problems early, but also intervening?
Yes, because this could potentially help in diagnosing the disease early, or perhaps would it help in treatment, this research?
Well, with Parkinson's, we have got good treatments. There's no cure at the moment. The earlier you can treat, obviously, the better. But diagnosis can be difficult. So that's why they're hoping that if you can find early warning signs, then you can get people the treatment they need before there's more and more damage in the brain. And other people have been looking at different ways. So recently we've heard about people looking at eye scans to try and see if there are little telltale signs at the back of the eye where you might see a bit thinner layer of cells there that might be predictive.
Michelle Roberts. The pop sensation Taylor Swift is currently on tour, performing more than 100 times across 5 continents with a massive fan base desperate to see their idol. Ticket sales are expected to pass $1 billion, the largest ever. Her presence can also have a huge economic impact on the cities she visits. On Thursday night, she kicked off the international leg of the tour with a concert in Mexico City. Olivia Wilson has this report.
Taylor Swift is set to make concert history once her Eras tour hits the $1 billion mark. But some say that could break $2 billion in North American ticket sales alone. But how did a 16-year-old singer-songwriter, whose career started in Nashville, Tennessee, become a global brand and the face of today's music industry, as the now 33-year-old continues to break records? Okay, full disclosure, I am a Swiftie, but that doesn't mean this won't be backed up by anything other than facts. She clearly never goes out of style. But this year's Eras tour doesn't just churn out billions without millions being pumped into it. Just setting up the stage is estimated to cost upwards of $100 million. The process of building it involves a team of an estimated 50 trucks operating on a tight schedule. It's reportedly the reason she gifted her drivers with a $100,000 bonus. So how has this tour managed to achieve significantly more success than her previous record-smashing tours?
By the time the Eras tour is done, she will have played 147 different football stadiums around the world, and the tour will have crossed $1 billion in just primary sales for tickets alone by the beginning of March next year.
That's Larry Miller, the director of the music business program at NYU Steinhardt. He believes it goes back to the smart marketing of her new album, Midnights. Taylor unveiled four separate vinyl editions of the album.
Her fans use the physical vinyl records as an expression of fandom. They may buy the records and put them on the wall. We understand that half of the vinyl that is sold is to young music fans who may not have a turntable.
But it's not just Taylor Swift who's cashing in on her songwriting success. The Common Sense Institute estimates that the Eras Tour could generate $4.6 billion in total consumer spending in the US. Hotels are one of the key businesses impacted by the Swift lift. Someone who knows this all too well is Tyler Morse, CEO of MCR, the third largest hotel owner-operator in the United States.
We own 9 hotels in Phoenix, and the Super Bowl was in Phoenix in January. There was also a big famous golf tournament on the same weekend. And across all of our 9 hotels, we ran $400 average daily rate, and we were full in occupancy. Taylor Swift came to town about 3 months later. For the 4-day weekend that she was in town, same 9 hotels, we ran an average daily rate of $900. So by my estimation, Taylor Swift is twice as popular as the National Football League.
Taylor Swift's business success is unusual due to the simple fact that most artists' financial success is scarcely built on just their music. A lot of artists venture into other industries such as fashion, makeup, beauty. But Taylor Swift hits different, as her monetary success is a direct result of her work in the music industry. And something tells me she'll be sticking around forever and always.
That report by Taylor Swift fan Olivia Wilson. And that's all from us for now. But before we go, here's Jackie with a look ahead to this week's Happy Pod.
In this edition, the huge relief in Pakistan after that incredible cable car rescue of 2 adults and 6 schoolboys. In India, the woman whose education was ended early through poverty and early marriage, but who just passed her 10th grade exam at the same time as her son. The volunteers in Switzerland protecting livestock from wolves, and therefore wolves from people. Still basking in the afterglow of the Women's World Cup, we will count down some of the best things about this year's competition, and we will have the best joke from the world's biggest arts festival, all in the Happy Pod, available from Saturday the 26th of August.
And there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This edition was mixed by Chesney Fawkes-Porter. The producer was Alice Adderley. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.